DuPont Company of Wilmington, Delaware, makers of better things for better living through chemistry, presents the Cavalcade of America.
On this most important day in our nation's history, Inauguration Day, Cavalcade of America presents a special broadcast entitled, Bless This House. Our star, McDonald Carey. The first occupant of the house, John Adams of Massachusetts, made a prayer upon his entrance at the portal, and he wrote it out that night in a letter to his wife. He wrote,
I pray heaven to bestow the best of blessings on this house and on all that shall hereafter inhabit it. May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof.
It has never been called a palace or a residency, this dwelling place. It's been a house like other houses, full of life and death, joy and sorrow. A house like other houses. Number 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C. The architect of the house, Captain James Loban, was an Irishman. He drew, to a degree, upon his memories of a stately home built by the Dukes of Leinster near Dublin. The classic lines we have retained down through the years. But it was to a raw, new, unfinished, swamp-haunted, comfortless giant of a dwelling that John Adams repaired toward the close of his term in 1800. His wife, Abigail, joined him in late November. And the end of November in Washington can be...
Cold, oh, so cold, John. It's so damp, so terribly damp.
What wood we had, I ordered burned in the fireplace to dry out the plaster before you came. The dampness comes from this confounded porous Virginia freestone in the walls.
And, John, do you know there's no place, no place at all to dry clothes? Well, surely we must wash clothes.
You just have to make do somehow, Abby.
Oh, I'll manage. I've already decided to use the great audience chamber to hang our wash in.
Good, good.
It's not these small inconveniences that worry me.
What is it, then?
It's you, John. Never have I seen you so disconsolate, so woebegone. And it's not the age from the walls that makes you so.
No, it's not. I suffer from a dampness of the soul.
Oh, John, what a strange remark. Oh, I don't think I've ever known you to be sorry for yourself before. Not out loud.
I'm not sorry for myself. But I never asked for this thankless task. Abby, listen to me. Not only have I not been able to get wood for these fireplaces from the commissioners, but from that stubborn herd of mules called Congress, I can have nothing. Nothing.
John.
I've been dropped at every time.
John.
Yes, Abby.
We have one fire at least. Now stop pacing up and down and sit quietly here where we can be warm. At least on one side.
All right, all right.
There. Now listen to me. Do you remember when we were living in Brattle Street in Boston? When we were young, before the war?
I do indeed.
But do you remember one special night when your friend Samuel Sewell came to call? He came in Tory power and glory to offer you a bribe, to win you over to the side of the King's party against your patriot friends.
And I refused.
Not before you talked with me. We sat late at night at our bedroom window, and we heard the watchman's call in the street below.
And all's well. And all's well.
Yes. I can almost hear it now. I listened and I said, all is not well. A storm is brewing in Boston Town. A blow to put the stars out.
The storm will try your strength, John, I said. But it will clear the air. After the storm, there'll be brighter stars ahead. I was right, John, then. And now that storm of revolution has tossed us up here at last to this strange, cold house. And there are new storms ahead.
There are always storms.
Always? But they pass. They do pass. Look, John.
Hmm?
Look through the window. What do you see?
I see the night.
Look again, John. It's a clear night. A clear night of stars.
After the New England Adamses, Mr. Jefferson, a widower, came to the house from Monticello, where he would have preferred to stay. His hostess, when he needed one, which was seldom with this Spartan Democrat, was Dolly Madison, wife of his closest friend. State occasions were few, but when they did occur, we are told the wines were magnificent. And on one notable occasion, the ingenious Mr. Jefferson outdid himself by inventing something very like Baked Alaska. James Madison followed Thomas Jefferson into the house, Jefferson's friend, almost a son or a brother. And the glamorous Dolly came into her own. You should spell her name, by the way, as she did, D-O-L-L-E-Y. But with Jimmy and his lovely bride, there came to the house in June of 1812... British troopers and marines came, under Cockburn and Ross, up from the river, closer and closer to the house, and to the president's wife.
I am Dolly Madison, and I want to say that it is true that I tucked the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution into my bodice and ran from the burning house. And it is not true that I hacked the Stuart portrait of George Washington from its frame and carried it off with the British at my heels. But most of all, it is not true that Jenny, my husband, was a coward and left me alone when the British came. He was with the troops at Bladensburg where he should have been. I went to him when I could. And on the way, I looked back at Washington through the smoke and the lightning of the storm. And I saw the house, our house, our lovely house, burning.
The house, quite young as houses go, was burned. The interior, still unfinished, was a smoke-blackened ruin, completely a ruin. But the free stone walls were left, and the house was rebuilt. Oh, yes, it was rebuilt. So the Virginian dynasty resumed, with James Monroe and Virginia Cortwright Monroe, who brought to the house their beautiful French furniture. Then, John Quincy Adams, the learned Yankee, who treated White House guests to disquisitions on poetry, music, painting, sculpture, all the old books say, of rare excellence and untiring interest. But a new storm was brewing. A storm of votes this time. Votes and voters out of the West, newly conscious of political power. Under Andrew Jackson, the old house would dance to a brand new tune. After his inauguration, Old Hickory rode from the Capitol to the White House on horseback. And he was followed by a mob of his supporters, rough and ready men and women from beyond the mountains. At the doors of the house, guards and ushers were overwhelmed. And into the stately East Room, the mob pushed its way to the long tables where cakes and ice cream and punch were laid out.
Disgusting, perfectly disgusting. It reminds one of the days of the French Revolution. I say, look at that woman.
that the news woman?
Right, he's actually wiping her hands on the window drape.
A chair, I fancy.
Oh, the chairs are much too small for these bears to sit on.
Good heavens, they've broken that beautiful bed so far.
Well, that's quieted things down a bit. My, this sort of thing would never do in Boston. Never do at all.
I don't suppose it would, gentlemen. But I find it a rather pleasing spectacle.
Oh, really?
And who might you be, may I ask?
My name is Andrew Jackson.
The true
resident.
Yes, I'm the one the fuss is for. But this is the people's house. Let them enjoy it. Special Inauguration Day broadcast starring MacDonald Carey as our narrator. Clever Martin Van Buren of New York, who bought a gold dinner service for the White House and lived to regret it, for he lost re-election because he was said to savor French sauces on golden spoons. There was much gaiety, much laughter down the years. And usually, there were children. Here in this house, young Tad and Willie Lincoln played with the two Taft boys from Cincinnati. And one day in 62... the four of them made a soldier doll out of rags and old clothes, and they called it Jack. Then they sentenced Jack, the soldier doll, to be shot at sunrise for sleeping on sentry duty. A gardener brought the news to the president's study. And back to the four very small boys came a message.
The doll Jack is pardoned by order of the president. A. Lincoln.
Old A. Lincoln came out of the wilderness.
Eleanor Roosevelt has said that if the White House is haunted, it is haunted by the shade of Abraham Lincoln. But many lonely men have walked these halls, up and down, up and down, trying to make the right decision. Very soon after the incident of the doll, young Willie Lincoln, who was 11, went riding on his pony in a chilly rain, and in a matter of hours fell sick of a fever. There was a ball planned for the White House, and Mrs. Lincoln couldn't bring herself to call it off. All night, while the Marine Corps band blared its music in the East Room, the parents took turns going up to see Willie. The boy lay ill for a few days, and the footsteps echoed outside his bedroom door.
Mr. President?
Yes, Mrs. Eckley.
Little boy. Little boy.
Little boy. He's dead, Mrs. Eckley.
Yes, it was very beautiful.
I knew.
Mr. President?
Mr. Nikolai?
It's the Secretary of War, Mr. Stanton, sir. He wants you to join him at the telegraph office at once. A dispatch from General McClellan.
Tell Mr. Stanton I'll join him within the hour. First, I must see my son. Mrs. Eckley, would you help me, please?
Mr.
out of the horrible burdens, a victory note. On a telegraph dispatch form dated April 2nd, 1865, Mr. Lincoln's pen scrawls in haste and joy,
Lieutenant General Grant at Appomattox, allow me to tender you and all with you the nation's grateful thanks. At your kind suggestion, I think I will visit you tomorrow. A. Lincoln.
Oh, there was fun, too, in this house. Plenty of fun. It was the beautiful Mrs. Polk who put in gas lighting. But at the first state reception, the gas supply failed. All would have been lost had it not been for Sarah Polk's forethought. She had kept candles in the East Room's giant candelabra. No one was left completely in the dark, and a merry time was had by all. Mrs. Benjamin Harrison installed electric lights when she began her campaign to exterminate the notorious White House rat. The current, direct current, was installed by a young mechanic named Ike Hoover, who stayed on at the house for 42 years as chief usher. But it was Grover Cleveland who first brightened up the White House with... White House wedding. The ceremony took place in the blue room, and when the bride, Miss Frank Clara Folsom, arrived...
My dears, I wish you could see her in the bridal gown. It's a heavy, oh, very heavy, ivory satin with a high, plain corsage, elbow sleeves, and a very long train. The bodice is bordered with a narrow band of orange flowers and leaves. And the train is at least 4 yards long. It's rounded, ever so slightly rounded. She looks beautiful. Just beautiful.
The president wore the canonical evening suit of black. And it was this president, Grover Cleveland, who, in the depths of the panic of 1893, discovered that he was suffering from a cancer in the roof of his mouth. Rather than further disturb a country in the throes of depression, he put to sea with a team of surgeons and suffered half of his upper jaw to be removed in secrecy on shipboard. The secret was kept for 25 years.
Yes, the White House is a place of terrible responsibility. And the sound of the White House is this sound. Back and forth. Back and forth. So Woodrow Wilson walked in the Lincoln study on an evening in the spring of 1917.
Good evening, Colonel House.
Good evening, Mr. President.
Sir, I speak your mind, my friend, always speak your mind. I have heard that you have made up your mind, sir.
I have, Colonel.
I shall ask Congress tomorrow to recognize that a state of war exists with Germany. What is your advice?
Sir, you know that I support your aims. To make nations as well as peoples subject to the moral law.
That is my dream, yes. I intend to act in that direction tomorrow. I see you have objections.
I scarcely know how to put them. I have spoken honestly with you in the past.
You have, my good friend.
Let me be utterly honest now. Mr. President, are you fit to conduct a war?
I don't know.
Of course you don't. You're too refined, too civilized, too intellectual not to see the utter absurdity of force. To conduct a brutal, vigorous, successful war, it needs a man of course of fiber.
I know. Yet men of thought must be prepared to become men of action. My friend, let me read you a part of the message I shall deliver to Congress tomorrow. This is what I have written. It is a fearful thing to lead this great, peaceful people into war.
But the right is more precious than peace. And we shall fight for the things we have always carried nearest our hearts. To such a task, we can dedicate our lives and our fortune. Everything that we are and everything that we have, the pride of those who know that the day has come when America is privileged to spend her blood and her might for the principles that gave her birth and happiness and the peace which she has treasured. God helping her, she can do no other. Teddy Roosevelt's young ones, exploring every nook and cranny of a mansion beginning to crumble under the weight of years. And the dogs. They were always there, the White House dogs. The earlier ones have no names, but most of us remember Mr. Harding's Laddie boy and Mr. Coolidge's two collies, Rob Roy and Priscilla Prim. And, of course, the immortal, the ubiquitous, Fowler. Fowler's master was too close to us for words without tears or anger. It was only yesterday. It was only yesterday that the signal bells announced the president's approach to his office. And we stood by the French windows leading out to the colonnade and watched him go by in his armless, cushionless, uncomfortable wheelchair, pushed by his Negro valet. When Fowler came abreast of the wheelchair as it rolled along, the president would reach down and scratch the little dog's neck. And we knew that whatever problems the day might bring, this man would find a way to handle them. But the house was faltering in all its joints, slipping sidewise and bottomwise down into the old district swamp. Plaster crumbled, ceilings cracked, and Margaret Truman's piano threatened to descend into the basement kitchen. Presidents from Teddy Roosevelt on had noticed the trembling of the old timbers, rigid as they were by countless experiments and improvements. Finally, just yesterday, under Harry Truman, the house was built anew, with everything of grace and charm preserved and kept, but with a new foundation of proud stability registered in steel. And today, under the eyes of all the world, the 34th chief executive has come to take his place in the home of presidents. In a time when the storm clouds gather again, and with a warning more grim than the past has ever known, Dwight D. Eisenhower, survivor of many storms, victor in the crusade for Europe, takes up his enormous burden under a roof that has sheltered much greatness, much sorrow, much joy. All America wishes him well. This genial man with the habit of victory. For him, we re-echo the prayer of John Adams, the prayer carved over the fireplace in the state dining room of the White House. I pray heaven to bestow the best of blessings on this house and on all that shall hereafter inhabit it. May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof.
Bless
thanks to McDonald, Terry, and the Cavalcade players for tonight's story.